Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 2:34 p.m. that is Central Time. Today is September 22nd. Before I start, I'd like to apologize for the issues that I'm getting with Vimeo. And usually it takes me about, well, it takes about 20 minutes for the video to upload. So usually when I have the link, I just post it. And when I see that the link is uploading, I've never usually had a problem before like that. So I do want to apologize that it just spent the whole night uploading and didn't complete the function. But I've noticed that there have been numerous issues with Vimeo recently. So I've been in contact with them and we'll see how that plays out. Now, when I look at the markets right now, I wanted to start off with gold. It rallied initially today. It's closing out the day unchanged. We're still in the region of about $1,675. And the big question is, when's the dollar going to roll over? I think that's really the only limiting factor in gold. We have deeply negative real interest rates. Inflation is well above where prevailing interest rates are. There's no way of measuring it any other way that makes sense. Now, with the determination of central banks like the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates aggressively, then the negative real interest rate is not as wide now as it has been, but it is still negative. And that's one of the key characteristics that people like to see in gold. But then you have the dollar, and the dollar is exceptionally firm, because of that willingness of the Federal Reserve to initiate a recession to bring down inflation. I think it's very important to highlight that inflation in the USA is about demand. Inflation in Europe is more about supply. And then in China, they don't have inflation, but they do have weak economic growth, and that's putting pressure on the global economy as well. And of course, because they have weak economic growth, then there's less demand for the inputs that go into manufacturing in China. So that's also having a net negative effect on the countries that rely on Chinese imports, like Australia. Now, then let's think a little bit about one other factor that has contributed to big bull markets in gold. It's something that I've noticed that if we look at the beginnings of secular bull markets in gold, there are a couple of things that come into play. So we have the weakness of the dollar and negative real interest rates. But at the beginning of the 1970s and at the beginning of the 2000s, there was a common phenomenon that's very seldom discussed. And it is that the US government was running a surplus. Right at the end of the 1990s, the US government practically had paid back its debt and was running surpluses because of the huge productivity gains that were accompanied by the internet. And then, in the period of the Nifty 50 and the wonderful economic expansion of the 1960s, the US government was also running a surplus. And it was after those surpluses that we saw spending balloon. So, the one thing, and I know this sounds incredibly cynical, but the one thing that we can rely on politicians to do is to spend when they have a surplus. And that created loss of faith in the purchasing power of currencies, and gold took off when it had that as a background and negative real interest rates and a weak dollar. So now let's just think about that. We don't have a government surplus in the USA on this occasion. So that's one factor that's not in play. However, what we do have are a clear willingness of politicians to spend money they don't have. And That's quite similar to what we've seen in the 70s and in the early 2000s. And we're at this point where we have restive populations and we have people that are very upset with their lot in life. And we have people that are not willing to accept fiscal austerity any longer. Obviously, in Europe, there was fiscal austerity to try and really instill or to kill moral hazard within the EU. And that resulted in a wave of nationalist sentiment. So there's just no way they're going back to that. Then in the USA, we have these continued worries about inequality. And this isn't going to go away either. And inflation is only going to make it worse. The Biden administration wants to cancel the student loans and continue to provide assistance to student loan borrowers, regardless of whether that is at the expense of people that didn't go to college or people who did work very hard to pay back their own loans. And then you have the significant spending, which was dubbed the Inflation Reduction Act, but realistically is about climate change. And that's hundreds of billions as well. As we head into a recession, most potentially it would be confirmed in 2023, then I don't think anyone is under any illusion that there's going to be significant additional spending measures. What we're seeing in the UK right now is probably a good example of what we can expect. So, the pound is still under pressure, and the UK administration today cancelled the national insurance tax hike announced back in April. The pound rallied initially and then gave up the advance. And there's lots of additional new spending measures. But one of the most important of those is that they're going to put levies, they're going to stop energy prices from rising. And that's basically a transfer of significant wealth into the energy providers and then also to the consumer. But what it will also help to do is to support the property price. So even though interest rates are higher and floating rate mortgages are going to start resetting, or fixed rate mortgages will start resetting, and floating rate mortgages will already have seen mortgage payments rise, there is still the potential that there will be supports for the property sector overall. So they're going to try and forestall a property crisis. And that makes sense. The entire European continent is on a war footing. So, in wartime, additional spending measures are always going to be deployed. So, but I guess the knock-on effect is that the pound is going to continue to trend lower. And of course, when we look at gold in other currencies, well, it's holding up a lot better when you look at pounds versus when you look at it in dollars. And in pounds, the gold price is bouncing from the 200-day moving average. When we think about it in terms of the euro, well, the euro isn't exactly a tower of strength right now. So it's also more or less in the region of the 200-day moving average. Now, we had quite a bit of volatility in the yen today. When I saw that move today, I thought, well, golly, it must be the Bank of Japan has intervened. But in fact, it was the government. And the Bank of Japan has not been raising rates. And they have decided that they're not going to, that they don't anticipate intervening to support the currency for at least the next 6 months. So it's the government attempting to support the currency. But the government doesn't have the power to print cash. That's the central bank's purview. So this probably represents a peak of short-term significance for the dollar and potentially Only a short-term one that we probably will anticipate that the yen will weaken further from here, at least until we see clear evidence from the Bank of Japan that they're willing to support the currency. And I think that it's particularly relevant to look at the CPI in Japan because we're coming up to around 3%, and the region of the peak from back in 2014 and 15, which was around the time of Amidamics, and this is really only the upper side of the base formation, and we haven't seen inflation in Japan holding a move above 3% for more than 30 years, and I think more, perhaps arguably, nearly 40 years. So the Bank of Japan isn't going to be all that eager to try and contain inflation. They probably see this as their one opportunity to try and change the deflationary mindset among the population. And in order to do that, they're going to have to try and get people to accelerate buying decisions rather than waiting for prices to come back down later. And that would suggest that the Bank of Japan is not going to intervene until inflation is above 5%. But of course, that also implies that the currency could go down quite a bit from where it is right now. Now, obviously, as we look at the 10-year Treasury yield in the USA surging higher today, and it was up nearly 17 basis points, this is a very clear breakout. And the more back history we look at, the bigger the breakout looks. So it has now quite clearly broken the downtrend. There have been multiple occasions over the course of the last 40 years when the yield has popped above the 1,000-day moving average, but every time it has failed. And now it is finding support in the region of the 200-day moving average and extending the bull market. So this continues to look like a trend that has further to go on the upside, even though we have a short-term oversold condition. Now let's just pay attention to the fact that on a total return basis, this looks worse. So the index has come down from 2,500 to 2,100 over the course of the last 2 years. And I think most particularly that we haven't ever seen a decline of this magnitude. And this has been the most consistent trend in the world for decades. And now it's breaking down. So there's the potential here that what we are in fact looking at is the end of a secular bull market in bonds. And brings us back to consider the basic truth of markets, which is everything is priced off the 10-year. The kind of market that we've been conditioned to expect is that bond yields will always go down and that the discount rate isn't really that important. But with the 10-year cruising higher and the 2-year still holding out around the 4% level. Well, what we're potentially being provided with here is a very significant discount rate. And that's a significant hurdle over which every other asset class has to get. So the Dividend Aristocrat Index is pulling back, and a subscriber today pointed out that it only yields 2%. And of course, that's true. And the defining characteristic of these types of companies is that they raise their dividends. So they're highly prized during times of inflation, which compresses their yields. But of course, that is assuming that their earnings hold up. I thought it was particularly relevant to look at a share like Costco. It was trending higher in quite a consistent manner until earlier this year, and then it dropped from 600 to 400 in the space of less than a month. Then it rebounded, and now it's rolling over again. This looks like a head and shoulders top formation. We have, and another way of thinking about it is we had the acceleration higher, a loss of uptrend consistency, massive reaction against the prevailing trend, and now a period of right-hand extension. This could pull back to $400 practically in a heartbeat. But the most important thing is it's looking like this exceptionally consistent trend that was remarkably persistent for more than a decade is over. And when we just ask ourselves the simple filter questions, do we have a consistent trend? No is the answer. So then, have we got evidence of top formation development? Yes. So these are very simple questions to ask and answer. And when it's that easy to answer these kinds of questions, well, then we have to give the benefit of the doubt to the downside. This is a very significant change. And I think it's important to highlight that there is a difference between arithmetic and logarithmic scales. So an arithmetic scale is always going to be more important to a levered investor. When we switch over to looking at a log scale, well, this is going to be more important to an unlevered investor. So when we look at it on a log scale, it's going to compress the view. And if we just zoom in and just look at the run-up from the lows in 2009, then even here we can see that there's a clear loss of momentum. Now, I think anybody can very clearly also see that there's still the sequence of ranges, one above another. But this range is bigger than anything we've seen since at least 2015. If it breaks down through the 400 level, then it's going to have broken the sequence of higher reaction lows. And it will also be pushing back down into the underlying trading range. So those are going to be even more inconsistencies in the primary trend. The big challenge for companies like this is that rising yields are problematic. Now, Costco is not a dividend aristocrat. You can see very clearly that the dividend tends to go up and down. But the bigger point is that it's a kind of company that has a lot of respect among investors and tends to be very favorably viewed by value investors because of the strength of the cash flows and because of the strength of the business and the franchise. And when companies like that start to roll over, then it's also indicative of a lot of pressure coming to bear on portfolios. So obviously, as a money manager, it's becoming progressively more difficult to outperform, and then also even more difficult to have positive, real, and alpha or positive returns on an absolute basis. So, what are people going to do? Well, I've looked at, there was a question today asking for a way for a UK investor to invest in short-dated US paper. I could not find a short-dated fund. But one problem with investing in bonds is that the bonds are trending down. So you might capture a yield, but your fund is going to underperform. And then the decline is going to eat up the yield on a mark-to-market basis. So this is obviously problematic. Now, I've seen, for example, Jeff Gundlach talking about the fact that there are 12% yields available in high yield. And that's true. But the time to buy those yields is when liquidity starts to become available once more. And buying them today, one is opening up the potential for a significant issue. We haven't had a default cycle yet. We're assuming that there's going to be a soft landing where the number of defaults will be low. And the reason we think that is because governments waded in and stopped defaults during the pandemic. Now, the question, of course, is whether they're going to be able to do that the next time around. So there's obviously risks here. And then we can think about the wider stock market. The S&P 500 is still trending downwards. It's coming back into the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And obviously now this is the question. Are we going to see dip buyers coming back in numbers now and do something similar to what we saw in June? But it's worth remembering why we had a rally in June. And it was because investors saw a deep pullback, so that was an oversold condition, and lots of short positions, so there was the potential to pressure those shorts by going long. But more importantly, at the end of June, there was a widespread belief that the Jackson Hole meeting would represent the pivot point for the Federal Reserve, and that at the meeting, Jay Powell would announce that they're going to stop raising rates any day now. So then this rally rolled over immediately afterwards when he did not give that signal. And we're down again in here today because yesterday he reiterated what he had to say at Jackson Hole, which was very simple. They're going to keep raising rates until they get the result they want. And they're pricing in another 75 basis points in November, which is only going to be a few days before the midterm elections. So we can anticipate that there is going to be plenty of volatility between now and then. And the most important thing about the buy the dip mentality is that every time we've had a sizable pullback into the region of the 1,000-day moving average, it has coincided with QE1, QE2, QE3. The European stimulus following the sovereign wealth crisis, the plunge protection team being utilized in 2018, then the pandemic stimulus, and now we're back at the region of the 1,000-day moving average, and financial conditions are tightening, central banks are raising interest rates, and paying no attention to the stock market. It's also, I think, particularly relevant that the incumbent in Washington right now doesn't talk about the stock market. If Donald Trump were in power, he'd be talking about the stock market every single day. And that's what he did just about every day he was in power. Whereas you just do not have the same support right now within the White House for the stock market. Now let's think about Bitcoin. And I remain of the view Bitcoin's a liquidity barometer. The price was up $400 in here today, so it is at least not breaking down. It's going to have to do more than this, though, in order to confirm that we have support. Now, the next big question is going to be about Tether, which is a major stablecoin, and they've been instructed by a court to provide their financials. Tether has often been accused of trying to support or inflate the Bitcoin price. And there's also been a lot of accusations that they don't have the assets that they claim to have, or that many of the assets they have are worthless. So the product of that court case isn't really about Tether, it's about finding out what they own. And if that stablecoin fails, it's a serious problem for Bitcoin. I don't know how much of that is already priced in, but certainly the price was up in here today. Now let's think about the oil price. So oil was up and down today and not quite breaking down through the $90 level on Brent crude, but certainly not holding the intraday high either. We have a very tight market where the protests in Iran are potentially significant, and that's a medium-term question. But in the short term, the US government looks like they're willing to start buying at $80. Now, the price of West Texas Intermediate is pretty close to $80 right now. So it does beg the question why they would put such a high floor in. But of course, the USA is now an energy exporter, so they would perhaps prefer to have a somewhat higher price overall. And that's equally true of natural gas. But there isn't a strategic reserve of natural gas, so prices there were down and coming back into the $7 level right now. I think what we should anticipate over the course of the next 6 months is a great deal of volatility in the natural gas price, because European storage is bumping up against physical capacity. So therefore, we should anticipate that they'll be buying when storage goes down, but they'll have nowhere to put it while storage is full. So that means there's going to be jerky supply and demand dynamics. But more, I think, importantly, is that Europe has done a lot to forestall the risk of being cut off from Russian energy this winter, and that it's probably not going to be as bad as people have been predicting. There's been a lot of money made from predicting the end of the world, but the end of the world hasn't arrived just yet. And I think that there's been a lot of fear mongering that Europe is going to both starve and freeze this winter. But I think that's perhaps over the top. But nonetheless, it does mean, though, that money has to be spent, and governments are going to blow out their budgets. They're going to spend way more money than they have. Debt to GDP ratios are going to get worse. And that's all in service to basically winning the war against Russia. And this is very clearly a war with Russia. It doesn't necessarily all have to happen on the battlefield. When we look at European stock markets, well, they're starting to also roll over. So the Euro Stoxx index is back in the region of the lows over the last 6 months. And it's hard to say, to really argue that prices can't go lower from here. And the FTSE 100 has held up pretty well relative to the FTSE 250, and not least because there's a lot of big dividend aristocrat type companies in that index, from miners to oil companies to healthcare companies. But there's been some big downward dynamics. This is clearly a range that's losing momentum, and stabs on the downside aren't encouraging. And then I think it's important to pay attention to the Nasdaq. So it's right in the region of the 1,000-day moving average, and this really is the decision point. I think the most likely scenario is that we do get another leg lower. One thing that is very clear is the Federal Reserve is targeting the housing market, and home builders are holding the region of the 1,000-day moving average, and we're in fact up in here today. But it's hard to make the case that home builders are going to do better from here with interest rates rising. They still have to borrow money to go out and build those houses, and they're going to have to pay more for it. So I think these are some of the difficult situations that we have out there. And it's still a very uncertain environment. cash doesn't look attractive, but cash doesn't go down as fast as some of these markets do. And I think that's something to just give some due consideration to. I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.